would like to, but I'm not finished. You lived with me in my own house, and we were not exactly strangers to each other, were we? So what I knew then, and what I know now, is that you loved the college. You were doing brilliantly. You liked your tutor, and you enjoyed your courses. And then suddenly, you didn't.
It became too difficult, Gran, Missa said.
But no one... Cease, please. Someone like you does not go from performing brilliantly to finding oneself unable to perform at all. Therefore, there's something gone on between those two points in your life. Now, from all her dancing round with the truth when I spoke to her, I reckon Ding Donaldson knows what's going on. But she's loyal to you, so what is it?
Missa had laughed, shortly, a bitter sound. She looked away from her grandmother. Rabia said,
What? You must tell me what. The London police have your details. They know where to find you.
Not these details, Missa said. They don't have these details.
You can tell them where I am, of course, but that's exactly what I intend to do if you don't speak to me honestly. I mean it, Missa. They're dealing with a suicide that they apparently believe is not a suicide, and if you think they're not intent on putting everyone through it to get to the bottom of what happened, you're being very naive. Your innocence has always been appealing, but... Missa, what?
The girl had begun to weep, soundlessly. She covered her mouth as if this would stop up the tears, and when this didn't work, she dug her fingernails into her skin deeply. Rabia got up and went to her. She embraced the girl and said into the side of her head,
Missa, what? Please. You must tell me.
It was the cider, she said.
Cider? What on earth? Cider?
I drank it and drank it. I didn't think cider did anything, but then I was drunk. It was all of a sudden and I couldn't go home. You'd see me just like Dad and Uncle David. I couldn't do it. I couldn't, Gran.
Ludlow, Shropshire. The sharp knock on her door was followed by Inspector Linley's mellifluous baritone, saying, Barbara, I'm sorry, but I must get you up. Isabel's phoned and...
Isabel. Isabel, Barbara thought with an inward scoff.
She said, Right, coming, and rolled out of bed. She was approaching the door when she realized she was wearing one of her slogan-bearing T-shirts, which she'd purchased in the largest size possible so that she could don it for sleeping. It was guaranteed not to amuse one's superior officer. And yet, despite the look on my face, you're still speaking. She called out, Let me get decent. He responded with, Of course, but I have seen the Buddy Holly pyjamas before now, if you recall. Cornwall? Caswellan? I wore blue and you wore Buddy Holly? Is this sounding familiar?
I think you were wearing a white towel, sir, having just performed your morning whatevers.
She was rapidly pulling on a pair of drawstring trousers. He spoke again. Was I? What a horrifying thought. I mean myself in a towel, in a shared bathroom situation. It hardly bears thinking about. Listen, Barbara, the Gov is waiting for me to ring her back. She's not happy that we both ignored her calls yesterday. I only need the Socco photographs, if that's of help. You can slide them under the door if you like. Barbara wasn't about to do that. She wanted to be in on whatever the DCS had in her head. She decided not to worry about the T-shirt, as a search through the pile of clothing had produced only two more of a similar ilk. So she went to the door and opened it. Linley was, of course, fully and nattily dressed. She saw him read the slogan on the T-shirt. He said, Ah, you've eschewed Buddy Holly.
Sorry, she said. I didn't expect you turning up like this.
I wouldn't have, had you not been in a state. The Gov, that is. And don't concern yourself about the T-shirt. I've seen far worse on your chest since you and I began keeping company. He frowned then and went on with, Sorry, that didn't come out quite as I intended. May I? He was referring to entering. She would have barged right into his room if their positions were reversed, but Linley was not a man for barging. She held the door open. She'd left the files on the coffee table, so he went to the sofa. For her part, she scurried to her clothes pile and dug through it more deeply to find an appropriate top. She took this into the bathroom, where she divested herself of the T-shirt, found her bra, where she'd left it dangling on a hook meant for a dressing gown, and once she had it on, she pulled a jersey over her head. When she left the bathroom more suitably attired, she found that Linley had donned his spectacles and was on his mobile. She also found that he'd put it onto its speaker capability, so that she could hear whatever Isabel Ardrey had to say. She was in the midst of, only of the body and what's nearby. The DCS waited on her end while Linley sorted through the Socco pictures and pulled from them every one that depicted Ian Druitt's body in situ. These he lay out on the coffee table. "I have them," he said.
"Is there one with a ligature in it?"
he said. "It wasn't a ligature, Gov. It was—"
"I know what it was, Tommy. Call it whatever you like, but find a picture that shows it and tell me what you see."
Barbara joined Linley on the sofa. They exchanged a look. But Linley did as he was asked and found a photo that showed both Druitt's body and the stole he had used to hang himself. It lay like a sprawled snake soaking up the sun. He said, "Got it, Gov." She said,
"Tell me what colour it is."
"The stole? It's red."
"There you have it," Audrey said.
Barbara had no clue what they had. Audrey was continuing, however.
"I was in a church last night,"
eyebrows lifted on both their parts,
"near the river. I'd gone for a walk, ended up close to Putney Bridge, and there was a church holding evensong. It was all quite formal. The choir, the priest, the praying and the singing."
Barbara rolled her eyes at the idea that Audrey was getting religion, but Linley seemed to understand that she was heading towards something.
"It was the priest, Tommy,"
Audrey said.
"The priest, or deacon, or whatever he was. I saw him, but it didn't register at first. Everything he was wearing was green."
Barbara had never been a churchgoer. Even at Christmas, Easter, or during national tragedies, she was not a believer, but Linley did not have a full chapel on his property for nothing. Not only were his ancestors and members of his more immediate family buried there, but services were held there as well, and he was part of a line of Asherton earls who'd been setting examples for the underlings for something like 300 years. Which was why she wasn't entirely surprised when he said, "My God." It was Lent when he died. He would have been wearing purple. The DCS said,
"It never occurred to me that the colour might have made a difference, but I was curious, so I went home and had a look online. Red is the one most rarely used, Tommy. Pentecost, Saints' Days, Confirmation, Ordination. I had a further look, and it wasn't a Saints' Day."
"And prior to Easter it wasn't Pentecost either," Linley said. "I should have seen that in the photos, Gov."
"No matter," Isabel said. "We've got him, I dare say."
"It looks that way," was Linley's reply. He rang off then and looked at Barbara. His expression was speculative, but Barbara felt speculation was not in order now. She said,
"It's like we always say, sir."
"What's that, Sergeant?"
"No one thinks of everything."
Ironbridge, Shropshire. Yasmina heard him upstairs. He was banging doors and drawers and cupboards as if he were a burglar searching for valuables. When she found him, he'd gone into the bathroom. This was strange, as it seemed to her that he would have gone there first. She knew what he was after, naturally. He didn't know just yet that when he hadn't returned home on the previous night, she'd taken action. But he was fast reaching that conclusion if his frantic search through a drawer that held first aid supplies was anything to go by. This must be his second time through the bathroom, then, she realized. He would have done the medicine cabinet earlier, before going on to the other rooms and at last returning here.
"I threw them away," she said from the doorway. "Well, a bloody goddamn course you did! What else should I possibly have expected?"
He pushed past her and went to their bed. He sank down, head in his hands, palms on his skull. He grabbed his own hair and jerked it back and forth. He finally looked up and said,
"Can you never leave anything alone?" "I'm sorry about Sati," she said. "When I hit her—"
"You mean when you punched her, Yasmina?
You do not mean hit her, because that isn't what happened. Hitting her would have been bad enough. Hitting your child because she doesn't want to do what you would have her do. But punching her? Do you have any idea what can come of that? Or are you relying on her making up a story when the head teacher asks her what happened to her face? He'll do that, you know. It's what he's actually meant to do. Will she say she ran into a door? I expect that one's never been used before by a child terrified of being taken into care."
He laughed wildly, got off the bed and walked to the window. His posture suggested he wanted to drive his fist through the glass, but he swung round on her instead, and she flinched. She said,
"Timothy, Sati wouldn't—"
"Shut up for once!
All Sati has to say is what actually happened to her, and no one is going to believe any story that you cook up to explain how our daughter ended up with her face beaten in." She advanced on him, but remained out of his reach.
"I didn't beat in her face. I didn't intend to hit her at all."
"It's rote. You're just like your father. What you did to Sati, that would have been his reaction." This was something—but it wasn't true. She said,
"I'm trying Timothy all my life. I've tried to...
Don't begin to say you've tried to do your best or any other rubbish you might want to trot out as an excuse for what's happened.
And I'll do you a favour and do the same. Here's what it is, Yasmina. You haven't tried, and I can't blame you because neither have I.
I could have stopped you, or laid down the law, or made threats, or whatever else a man's meant to do to bring sanity into his home, and I didn't because you made it simple for me to step aside. So that's what I did, and believe me, I do not fucking want to have to face that.
I want my children back, Yasmina said. I meant to protect them.
From what, exactly?
Bad things,
she said as she sought an answer that would encompass what she felt when she considered their children.
Ruining their lives, making mistakes, that's my job.
But you won't see that. And really, why should you? It's easier to blame me for everything when all I've ever wanted is what's best for us all. Determined by who? No, don't answer, I already know. So does Missa. So does Sati now. He headed for the bedroom door. She stepped in front of him.
You can't say that I...
He pushed her aside. You haven't been listening, because that's your stock in trade. I've already told you I'm to blame as well. You were just doing what had been done to you. I don't have that excuse. He left the room, but she followed him. Down the stairs he went with her on his tail. She said,
What was done to me, as you put it, was seeing to it that I was educated well, that I found a course in life. If it constitutes some kind of failure that I want to do the same for my children, then I'm guilty.
He was at the bottom of the stairs, and he turned, a fist clenched on the rail.
I swear to God, you don't see anything. Your family rejected you, Yasmina. Not a single one of them has spoken to you in 20 years. And why? Because you made one mistake. You got pregnant.
No, that's not fair. I made you pregnant. And they were completely unwilling to see that one mistake might not ruin an entire life.
It made life more difficult. I don't want life to be difficult for my daughters.
Really? He asked. How's that working for you, then? She made no reply. How could she, when she saw at last that they were going round and round, and would continue to do so? You're going to end up with nothing, Yasmina, he told her. Me, though? I'm not going there with you. He headed for the door. She said,
Your mum told us
stop it, he cut in. Just bloody stop it. Which was when the front door opened. Rabia entered. Missa was behind her.
Thank God,
Yasmina cried, dashing down the rest of the stairs. But then she saw, and she asked,
Why have you not brought Sati with you?
Sati is not meant to hear. Rabia drew Missa into the entry and closed the door. Yasmina felt a distinct prickling of dread, worse than anything she'd felt since just before receiving Jana's fatal diagnosis. She could see from her face that Missa had been weeping. She could see on Rabia's face that whatever Sati was not meant to hear was going to be said by Missa. Suddenly Yasmina did not want to listen. What swept over her was a tsunami of knowledge that told her one clear thing. Whatever had been on her daughter's mind for months had nothing to do with Ironbridge, Justin Goodale, or marriage. Rabia led Missa into the sitting room. She sat next to her on the sofa and told Yasmina and Timothy to sit as well. Yasmina took one of the wing-back chairs. Timothy came into the room, but he remained standing.
I got badly drunk on cider,
Missa directed her words down to her lap, where she clenched her fists together. The tsunami of knowledge altered to one of relief. This was what Missa had wanted to talk about. She'd known how upset her parents would be that she'd got drunk, because she'd also known her uncle's history, her father's history, and her great-grandfather's history. She had been told from the first how dangerous drinking was in their family, and she had always been fully on board with the facts of how dangerous drinking could become for her. Yasmina said,
Missa, darling, darling, you've no cause for...
Rabia snapped. Let her go on, in a tone so harsh that Yasmina backed deeply into her chair. Missa looked at her grandmother. Rabia nodded. Yasmina wanted desperately to tell her that nothing could ever alter her parents' love for her, that all she'd done was what children do as they grow up. They experiment just as she had done, and that was the only thing that had happened.
I didn't know what cider would do, so when he kept ordering me another and another, I drank it because of how good it tasted. At first I was only a little light-headed, but that didn't seem to matter because it was... Well, it was fun, and I thought about breaking out of who I always am and at least trying something new, because you know how I've always hated to do that. And then I was terribly drunk, only I don't even remember that part of it. That's how drunk I was. I don't remember much of anything, except that...
Even across the room from her, in a wing-back chair, Yasmina could sense Missus' tension. Rabia smoothed the girl's hair behind her ear. She murmured something Yasmina couldn't catch. Missa drew a shallow breath. She lowered her head.
I slept on the sofa. I don't even remember how I got there. I only remember that when I woke up it was completely dark in the room, and he...
She raised one of her clenched fists and pressed it beneath her right eye.
He was on top of me. I couldn't move. I couldn't even breathe. And then...
Her shoulders shook. Yasmina could tell that not only was she weeping, but also that she didn't want her parents to see that she was weeping.
"You must tell them, Missa," Rabia said. "They need to know so that they can begin to understand."
Timothy took a step forward, as if he intended to go to her. Rabia stopped him at once with,
"Sit down and stay down. Now!"
And he did so at once. There was a second wing-back chair not far from Yasmina, and that was where he sat, on the edge, though, as if he would spring into action at the least provocation. Nonetheless, he spoke gently, saying,
"Missa,
talk to us, please." She raised her head. Yasmina drew in a breath because on her daughter's face she saw at last the profound suffering she'd been hiding for months. Missa said,
"I wasn't dressed when I woke up. I mean, my skirt, my tights, my... I didn't know that at first, but then he started shoving his... It was... I wanted to fight him, but I was on my stomach, and he put his hand over my mouth, and he jerked back my head, and then he was... He put his... Oh, God!"
Yasmina covered her mouth.
"I could hear him grunting and grunting, and it hurt so much, it hurt so much!"
Timothy surged to his feet.
"Who?"
he demanded.
"Who was it? Who?"
"Mum,"
Missa said, with tears falling that she didn't even seem to be aware of.
"Mummy, it hurt so much, and I wanted it to stop, and I couldn't do anything. And Gran, don't make me. Don't make me. Please."
Rabia put her arms round the girl. Yasmina tasted the blood from where she'd bitten down on her fingers as Missa was speaking. Timothy began pacing the floor. He said,
"Who was it? You tell me."
"She doesn't know, for God's sake," Rabia said. "She's never known."
He swung on her.
"What about you? She says she was on the bloody sofa, Mum. Someone got into your house and did this to my daughter, and do you understand? Inside your head is the name, so think."
He approached her. He grabbed her face, and he squeezed as if it were a piece of fruit that he wanted to crush. Missa cried,
"Don't!"
Rabia shook him off.
"You're not understanding." "Don't tell Justy," Missa made it a plea. "Please, you can't tell Justy. I talked and talked about being a virgin and how I wanted to wait because of what happened to Mum and how she got pregnant and how that made things so difficult for her because she wasn't ready and you weren't ready and..."
She turned to her mother.
"Mummy, I'm still a virgin, aren't I? Because of how he did it, I'm still a virgin, yes?"
Yasmina felt every particle of the horror attached to that moment.
"This was why you wanted to come home," she said. "But I was the one who knew better than anyone. And all along, my dear God, this was why."
She wanted to slap herself repeatedly. She understood the inclination of women to chop off their hair in mourning and pour ashes over themselves from head to foot. Could she have, at that moment, she would have done so.
"Oh, blessed God, Missa," she cried. "Tell me, please, what can I do?"
Rabia was the one to answer.
"You can listen to the rest of it. Both of you."
Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley's thought was that he should have seen it sooner. He couldn't blame Havers. She wasn't a churchgoer, as far as he could recall, and although there had been a funeral service for her father, how would she be expected to know that there was meaning behind the colours worn by the clergy? On her own admission, Isabel was not a member of any congregation either, but he... He couldn't say he believed in anything divine, but he'd attended church services until he was at university. Once he'd ended his long estrangement from his mother, he'd also attended at her side when he was in Cornwall. So he should not only have seen that the stole on the floor next to Druitt's body was red, he should also have realized what that meant. He gave Havers time to put herself together while he returned to his own room and thought about their next move. They had an assortment of half-mad evidence that told them it was highly likely and practically assuredly murder. But while what they had might suffice to reassure Clive Druitt that his son had not committed suicide, it did not take them closer to an arrest, a charge, and what Druitt wanted and justice demanded, a prosecution. If he and Havers handed over what they had to the Crown Prosecution Service, the sheer incredulity of any barrister involved would end up shaming both the West Mercia police, who'd allowed this to happen upon their patch, and the Met, who'd trotted up here in an attempt to pour oil upon the waters surrounding a rich man who had every right, as Linley now knew, to be hauling in either a legal team or a national journalist with a bent for humiliation-producing investigative reporting. He could even hear the first question from the prosecutors that he would be called upon to answer, should he present the CPS with what they had. And a red stole on the floor proves what, exactly? With the additional, "For all you know, Detective Inspector, the victim might well have been colourblind. Come back when you know that, and when you also know why anyone might want to kill the man." He and Havers could, Linley knew, only look at each detail as it came up. They had little enough time and no manpower, so their next move had to be something that shed light. He was listing potential actions in his head as he went down to the breakfast room to meet Havers. She was waiting for him at reception, her expression telling him that a meal was the last thing on her mind. She said, "Let's haul him in, sir." "We're not quite there yet," was his reply, and he could see at once that this did not please.
"Sod it! What else do we need? A bloody dagger with his fingerprints on it?"
"That would be helpful," he said, "but first we need to speak to the vicar."
"And this would be for what bleeding reason?"
"He'll let us into the vestry."
"And we need to get into the vestry another time for?"
"For the assurance that what we think was done actually could be done. At the moment we have nothing but supposition." Arranging to have another look at the vestry was a matter of making a single phone call. The vicar said he would happily meet them at the church at a time of their choosing. They set off after breakfast, up the mild rise of Dinham Street and through Castle Square. As he'd promised, Christopher Spencer was waiting for them inside the church, happy to help them. When Linley asked the vicar if he might leave them alone in the vestry, he looked mildly surprised, but after a moment of contemplation he said of course, showed them back to it, and told them he would be waiting in the St. John's Chapel. Before he left them, Linley asked the man if his deacon had been colour-blind. Spencer reassured them that Ian Druitt was not, as far as he knew. He'd certainly never donned the wrong vestments, and that would indicate he saw colours normally, wouldn't it? He asked. Did the vicar know that Druitt had ostensibly used a red stole to hang himself? Linley wanted to know. Spencer did not. And he wouldn't have noticed a red stole missing, as the next time it was worn would be Pentecost, which hadn't yet arrived. After that, the vicar left them to it. "We know Druitt was finishing up a service when Ruddock arrived to arrest him," Linley said quietly when they were alone. "We also know that he removed his vestments and stowed them prior to setting off."
"Does a deacon do evensong in full fig?" Havers asked. "Does a vicar, for that matter?"
"I don't think we need to be concerned with that at the moment," Linley replied. "We just need to keep in mind that the stole's size indicates it would go on last, as the final bit of whatever else he had on." He went to the large cupboards on one side of the room, opening them to reveal black cassocks and white surplices. Havers, as he reckoned she would do, twigged at once.
"If the stole goes on last, it comes off first. When you open the cupboards with the larger pieces, your back is to the set of drawers on this side, where the stoles are kept. But Ruddock would have seen him take off a purple stole, right? So if he's our bloke, why wouldn't he pinch the purple stole, or any purple stole?"
She opened the drawers to see how many stoles there were.
"There was only one purple one. There's only one of each. So what happened? If Druitt took it off, why not just pinch it when his back was turned?"
"Perhaps Druitt didn't take it off over there with the rest of the stoles. Perhaps he removed it on this side of the room and placed it on the bottom of the cupboard while he hung up his surplice, removed his cassock, hung it where it went, and then turned to cross the room and put the stole where it belonged,
giving Ruddock time to ease the drawer open,
and perhaps it was even more than one drawer,
and pinch the first one that he came across. But why wouldn't he see the difference?"
"If he's not a churchgoer, he wouldn't know there was a difference. Besides that, he's not yet sure how he's meant to do away with Druitt. He only knows that he must."
"Then that means—"
She seemed reluctant to say it, which was out of character in Havers, and spoke of her reluctance, at the end of the day, to see how badly a copper can go wrong. "Yes. Druitt wasn't brought into the station because of paedophilia. He wasn't awaiting transfer to Shrewsbury. Those 19 days are what tell us that, Barbara. You saw that the moment you caught the date of the original phone call that set the ball in motion.
Braddock was obeying orders from the first. If he's our man, he's not the only one.
After a moment of thought, she said,
"Bloody hell, Inspector!"
"Indeed," he replied. He turned back to her so that they could consider their next move. That was when her mobile phone rang. St. Julian's Well, Ludlow, Shropshire. When Rabir rang off, she returned the detective sergeant's card to where she'd shoved it after her first encounter with the Metropolitan Police. She went back to the sitting room, where Missa was huddled into a corner of the sofa, clutching a pillow to her chest like a child with a security blanket. She had made it clear in Ironbridge that she would go through the story another time, only if neither of her parents was present. There was nothing that the police could do now, not at this extreme of time, she declared. Because of this, Rabia had given the girl her full support when it came to returning to Ludlow without Yasmina. As for Timothy, he'd taken himself out of the picture at the conclusion of Missa's story. It had been as dreadful listening to her tell the story a second time as it had been the first in the privacy of the Goodale home. This time, however, had been made even more difficult by Timothy's reaction. Once he understood that what had happened to Missa had not happened at her grandmother's house, his demands of the girl became as furious as they were adamantine.
"Who was it?"
he demanded past Missa's tears. His voice was loud and rock-like.
"Who? Think! You must know!"
"Stop it!" from Yasmina, who'd risen to her feet and tried to move him away from their daughter. Missa cried,
"I don't know. It was dark, and I couldn't—" "Then who gave you the cider, and why the hell did you keep drinking it?"
"Don't make this her fault," Rabia ordered her son.
"We were celebrating,"
Missa tried to breathe past her terrible sobbing.
"End of term. We finished exams. We were—" "Don't tell Justy. Please don't tell Justy."
"You goddamn tell me!"
Rabia intervened, for it was clear her granddaughter had had enough. She said,
"Ding came to fetch her for an evening out. I told her to live a little for once. I went to bed because I knew she'd be out late. I'd already paid for the driver to fetch her to Quality Square and then to bring her home, so I thought everything was taken care of. I was too drunk," Missa wept. "So she spent the night at Ding's, and that's where this happened. I couldn't go home to Gran, Dad. I couldn't do that to her. So she passed out on Ding's sofa, and someone inside that house sodomized her because she'd blacked out, and if everything went as he hoped—"
"Oh, Missa!"
Yasmina cried.
"She wouldn't regain consciousness during the act, and the only way she would know exactly what happened was from the blood and the pain the next morning."
"Why didn't you tell us?"
Yasmina cried.
Timothy said, "One of those boys in that house gave you that cider, and you will tell me which one it is, because he's going to pay for this. Who was it?"
"I never would have made you return to Ludlow if I'd known."
This from Yasmina, who was extending her hands to Missa, but clenched as if waiting for handcuffs to be put on her.
"Why did you never tell me? It was my fault."
Missa's voice grew louder.
"Don't you see that? I was drunk because I liked the taste. No one made me drink it. No one drugged me. It's on me that I did it, and all I want is to forget it all, which is what I've wanted from the first. So I won't tell you anything else because it's my fault, and I got what I deserve for being so stupid and drunk that I couldn't even go home."
"No!"
Yasmina approached her as Timothy had done. Missa shrank from her advance.
"You're punishing yourself." "No!"
Missa shouted.
"No, no! But Missa, my love, you must see now that—"
"Stop it!"
she shrieked as she covered her ears.
"Gran brought me here to tell you, and I told you, and I won't talk about it any longer."
"Christ! Christ!"
Timothy cried. He ran from the house. And now, in Ludlow, Rabia and Missa waited. Sergeant Havers had said to Rabia, "We'll be there directly, quick as we can." 20 minutes after the phone call, they turned up. Rabia had never thought she'd be grateful to have Scotland Yard on her doorstep another time, but she was now. She ushered them into the sitting room, where Missa remained. Sergeant Havers took a notebook and a mechanical pencil from her bag, depositing herself in a chair next to the fireplace. Inspector Linley sat on the ottoman that served duty as a coffee table. He said with quite a lovely smile, "Ah, Missa, we meet at last. We've heard about you from Greta Yates and from your friend Ding. We understand you were an exceptional student here during autumn term." Rabia could see Mrs. Grip tighten on the pillow she still held. The inspector perhaps saw this as well, because he next said, "Are you well enough to speak to us? This can wait if you're not feeling up to it just now." This, Rabia saw, garnered him a look from the detective sergeant. It said, "Are you mad?" as clearly as if she'd spoken it. Linley then said, "I ask because sometimes speaking to the police is unnerving for an individual, especially for a young person. I know your grandmother has a solicitor. Would you be happier if he were present?" This second bit from the inspector resulted in another look from the sergeant. This one appeared to be asking, "Have you gone straight round the bend?" Missus said,
"No, Gran, I don't have to—"
"No, no, you don't," Rabia told her. "It's entirely your decision, my dear. He's my own solicitor, but you don't have to have him present. I'll stay with you if you like, or I can leave you alone with the police." Staying was Missus' preference, so Rabia joined her on the sofa as she'd done in Ironbridge. Missa told the story as she'd told it before. Sergeant Havers wrote at a pace suggesting she was taking down every word. Linley merely listened gravely. When Missa was finished, Linley was silent for a moment. He seemed to be considering every aspect of what she'd said. Finally he responded with, "I am so profoundly sorry." After another moment he went on, "Am I correct that this was what you were talking to Ian Druitt about?" Missa shook her head. There was fringe on the pillow she held, and she began to twist it between her fingers.
"He rang me because of my tutor,"
she went on to explain the chain of phone calls that ended up with Ian Druitt contacting her.
"He asked did I want to meet with him because the college was concerned how I was doing. I didn't want to talk to him, but I did, because—"
She looked away. Her brow furrowed as if she were trying to sort out what had gone on in her psyche that she'd agreed to meet with Ian Druitt. Rabia offered the answer when she said,
"Because that's what you've always done when an adult asks for your cooperation."
Missa gave a small moan. She nodded.
"I talked to him about wanting to leave college. I told him about the coursework being too difficult, but he could see there was something more, because, obviously, it hadn't been too difficult in autumn term. He probed and pressed. He was very kind."
"So you told him what you've told us just now?" Linley asked.
"Not all of it. I just couldn't."
"Do you mean the sodomy?"
"I couldn't tell him that part. It was too horrible, and anyway, it was too late to do anything. It was months and months too late, and really, all I want now is for Justy not to ever know."
Linley nodded. "That's understandable. But can you tell me what you mean when you say, too late?"
"There wasn't any evidence."
Rabia saw the sergeant raise her head quickly and look to Linley, who said, "When something like this happens, there's always evidence. There wouldn't be any on your body by the time you spoke to the deacon, of course, as you would have healed and the DNA would have been long gone. But elsewhere. What did you do with your clothing?"
"That's just it," she replied. "I had it."
Sergeant Havers was the one to say, "You have it?" So quickly it was as if she couldn't contain herself.
"I put it in a bag," Missa said. "My underwear, my tights, I shoved them to the back of a drawer because I didn't want ever to forget what happened to me because I'd been so stupid one night."
"You weren't stupid, and you aren't stupid," Linley said as his sergeant went on with,
"Is all of it here? Is it in this house? Did you take it to Ironbridge?"
Linley shot her a look that silenced her. To Missa he said, "You merely made a mistake, like millions of other young people your age. You were badly hurt from it,
because I—"
"Not because of anything. That's where you're going rather wrong. You're seeing these two events as related. You were drunk, ergo, you were viciously assaulted. But while these events occurred one after the other, the first did not cause the second."
"I wouldn't have been—"
"That's what you can't know." In the silence that followed, the sergeant said, "Sir?" with an urgency that the inspector didn't seem to feel. Rabia was conscious of gratitude sweeping over her at the compassion this man was taking the time to show her granddaughter. Missa said,
I suppose."
Linley said, "I've been a cop for a good many years, so I feel confident about saying you must go beyond supposing." He glanced at Rabia. She nodded and let her lips form the words, "Thank you." He went on, "Can you tell me about the clothing? You shoved the undergarments to the back of a drawer? Then what?"
"That's why I know it was too late.
I gave them to Mr. Druitt. He said he would give everything to the police, and they would test it, and I wouldn't have to talk about it ever again to anyone." What happened to the results of the testing? Did he tell you?
He said he got told there wasn't any evidence. I mean, there wasn't any evidence of anyone, you know.
Rabia saw the sergeant start to speak, but stop herself as Linley lowered his head for a moment and appeared to consider what Missa had told him. Then he said, "What about the rest of the clothing you had on that night, Missa? What did he say about that?" She shook her head.
"There wasn't anything else. The clothes I was wearing that night, they weren't mine."
Rabia felt like someone seeing the dawn for the first time, as she suddenly understood the rest of the story.
"My God," she murmured, "of course they weren't yours."
Ludlow, Shropshire. Ding could easily ride her bicycle to pay a call upon Francie Adamucci, because Francie lived just beyond the old almshouses in Ludford, not far from the bridge. As it was fairly early, she found Francie still at home as she'd reckoned she'd be. She was about to set off on her own bike, but when Ding coasted onto the semicircle of gravel driveway at the house's entrance, Francie paused, looked wary, which was something of a surprise when one considered how casual she was about everything, and said,
"Hey, can we talk?" Ding asked. "You put me straight into it with the cops, Francie."
Francie looked behind herself at the windows of the house, as if she expected eavesdroppers or something. The only thing that was visible, though, was a deep window-sill that held a display of African-looking stuff, carved figures, a couple of tattered baskets, a truly hideous mask. Ding reckoned it was all there to prevent break-ins. With taste like that, who would want whatever else was inside?
"Yeah," Francie said. "I'm sorry, Ding. It more or less slipped out. It was all the rubbish with Raddock." Gosh, that sounds like a song or something. "The Rubbish with Raddock." Or the title of a book.
That was vintage Francie, Ding told herself. She could derail any conversation within 10 seconds. Not that she intended to. It was simply how her crazy brain worked.
"So, whatever. Can we talk?"
Francie shrugged.
"It's geography anyway, like I care. The world's going to be destroyed by some idiot shooting off nuclear missiles at some other idiot anyway. I don't know why I'd bother. Come on."
It hadn't been Ding's idea to go inside the house, but that was where Francie headed. Ding said,
"Are you Mum and Dad?"
Francie laughed shortly.
"You think they're here? It's the 23rd of May. There's got to be some major ethno-cultural whatever event going on somewhere on the planet."
She shoved her key in the lock and opened the door. Ding left her bike propped up against one of the pillars in front of the house. She'd never been to France's, so she hadn't known it was a serious-looking structure probably listed by the government. She said as she followed in France's wake and found herself in a soaring entry,
"What was this place?"
Francie looked round as if seeing the building for the first time.
Clueless. No central heating, no double glazing, plaster cracking, chimneys useless. All I want in life is to end up in a place built any time after 1900. I'm out of here as soon as I can manage it.
I didn't know that.
What?
The house. I mean, where I live. My mum. You've seen it. Why do you never say?
At least your mum's trying to do something with it. This place'll crumble round everyone's ears before my parents realise they might want to take a look round and see if it's even livable. You want something?
She led them to a kitchen that at least had been modernised into what appeared to be post-war condition.
I can do with some toast. There's Marmite.
Ding had no appetite. There was a battered table in the centre of the room with stools round it, and she sat on one of these. For her part, Francie hopped onto the worktop, found a banana hidden behind a pile of carrots and onions on the windowsill, offered it to Ding, and when Ding shook her head, peeled it for herself.
"The cops said you were seen with Raddick like I was," Ding said. "Why'd you never tell me, friend?"
Francie chewed the banana and scratched the side of her head.
"It only happened once. I mean, when he tried his game with me, so it didn't seem like a big thing. And anyway, I dealt with him.
It was totally different to how it was with you."
"How?" "He couldn't threaten me."
She waved casually round the kitchen, but it seemed she meant the entire house when she said,
"Do you really think my mum and dad were going to agitate themselves 'cause Francis is drunk? That would have required them to be involved in something beyond their ethno-cultural whatever experiences, so he couldn't tell me that he was going to do something to force me to return home if I didn't play his game, since I already live here. Swear it, Ding, I never had the first clue what that bloke thought he'd ever get from me."
"Is that why it only happened once? That he put you in his car?"
"Well, it was 2 times, but the second time I met up with him. See, I told him that first time that if I fancied blowing him,
which at that moment I did not, officer, then I'd go ahead and do it. But as I didn't, he could just take me home if that's what he wanted to do.
Did he?
Of course. I don't know what he thought was going to happen, but Mum and Dad were like, don't wake us again, constable, or whatever you are. And then when he left, it was all Francie, for God's sake, give up the drink before you pickle yourself. And that was it. Sometimes, Ding, I've got to tell you, it truly helps to have parents who do maximum laissez-faire. They're bloody lucky they are that I gave up trying to get their attention directly they missed my 10th birthday.
There was no humour in Francie's laugh.
Ding said, that's awful, Francie. I never knew. Like I care about them.
Francie hopped down from the worktop, tossed her banana skin into the sink, and stretched her arms above her head.
Anyway, that first time he tried with me and it didn't work. I said he should give me his mobile's number, and if I wanted to do it, I'd give him a bell. I thought as if, at first. But one night I was, like, totally blotto, and I decided to see what it was like to do a copper, so I rang him. That might have been when I got seen alone with him.
Where'd you go?
I mean, where'd he take you? Car park behind the college. What about you?
Police station.
Shit.
Inside?
Mostly the car park, but it depended what he wanted.
Fucking animal. You need to report him.
I told the London cops. I more or less had to.
They'll sort him, Ding.
Francie had been prowling the kitchen as if she couldn't rest for even a second, but now she stopped to say,
I'm that sorry about it.
You didn't know.
I mean, how bad it was.
Oh, right. I mean, Brutus, though. I know I said sorry before, but I suppose I'm sorrier and all that.
Oh.
Ding wasn't sure she wanted to talk about Brutus, not after what she'd learned versus what she'd thought. But Francie looked so anxious about things that Ding decided to lay Brutus at rest as well. She said,
you don't need to be sorry. I never told you he was, like, that special to me.
Yeah, but... Well, I could tell you were totally special to him, and I did it anyway.
Believe me, Francie, I'm not special to him.
Then you don't know him like you should. You're absolutely special to Brutus. He's got a lot to figure out, starting with why he's got this unquenchable woman thing going on. He might not ever figure that part of himself out, since blokes like him generally don't, right? But you're the special one. You're number one to him.
Is that supposed to make me feel good? That I'm at the start of whatever bonking queue he's got going on?
Oh, gosh, I didn't mean you should stick with him. What I meant is that how he acts, that's got nothing to do with how he feels about you. Far as what I think you should do goes, I'd connect the toe of my shoe with his arse if I were you. He's a lovely bloke, but really, why waste your time?
Yeah, really.
Ding found that she was able to smile at Francie, which she certainly hadn't thought she'd be able to do when she made the decision to come over the river to speak with her. But she now understood the other girl far better than she'd considered possible, and that told her something about looking more deeply at her friends than she'd done in the past by Googling them. After their conversation, they were at peace with each other. They rode together over the Ludford Bridge, and they parted at the bottom of Broad Street, with a plan to meet for a Chinese meal in 2 days' time. Ding went in the direction of Teenside as Francie shifted gears to climb the hill. At the house, though, Ding paused because the front door was open, and she was certain she'd shut it upon leaving earlier. She hadn't locked it because they'd lost the keys months ago and there was nothing to steal anyway except their laptops, but even now she had hers in her rucksack, and she knew the boys would have theirs as well if they'd left. Still, the door hanging open like that was rather much. It was one thing to be careless, it was another to send out invitations. Once she was inside, she hesitated because when she shut the door behind her, she could hear what sounded like pounding going on above stairs. Then there was a crash, a shout, grunting and yelling. Then the sound of blows, and someone's voice hurling, "You bloody touched her!" at someone else. Brutus, she thought. She ran up the stairs. It seemed he'd been caught at last by another girl's boyfriend. Ding found him in his bedroom doorway. He was sprawled on the floor on his stomach, and his arm was at such a terrible angle to his body that she fell to her knees, crying his name. But when she touched him, he shrieked like an animal badly shot. She cried,
"Is it Finn? Do you fight with Finn?"
But she became aware that the noise hadn't ceased, and Brutus managed to say,
"He's on Finn now."
And she ran to Finn's room, crying,
"Who? What's happening? Finn?"
The door was partially closed, and it was suddenly quiet inside, and she was terrified to see. As she was about to push it open, a man stormed out. He looked completely wild, and she thought a meth addict had broken into their house. She shrank back and covered her head to protect herself, but instead of attacking her as well, the man pounded down the stairs. She saw Finn then. He was in far worse condition than Brutus. His head was bleeding from a terrible gash, and his face looked torn up, as if someone had tried to rip off his cheek. She didn't know if he was still alive. She flew down the stairs in the wake of his attacker, not because she knew what to do, but because she didn't. Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley was concerned when he learned that Missa had told the story of the attack upon her to her parents only that morning. He became worried when he discovered that, at the conclusion of Missa's informing them of this attack, her father had left the house in an understandably wild state of mind and had not been heard of after that. But when he and Havers ended their drive to Teamside, only to find both an ambulance and a patrol car in front of the house in which Dina Donaldson lived, he feared they were too late. The worst had happened, and another tragedy would be piled upon those that had already occurred. As he pulled to the curb, Linley could see that the boy Brutus was being led from the house by a patrol officer. The boy's right arm was bound in a temporary sling against his chest, and Linley might have thought that an arrest was occurring, save for the fact that the officer paused to wait until a paramedic joined them, at which point he went to the driver's seat of the car, climbed inside, and started the police lights spinning. Brutus was then loaded into the car by the paramedic, who spoke to the boy, belted him in, and then trotted back to re-enter the house. The car pulled away, the siren hooting twice to clear the roadway. The officer made a turn into Old Street, and as this wasn't the route to the Ludlow police station, Linley reckoned he was taking the boy to the closest A&E. The ambulance remained where it was. Havers said, "This is dead bad, sir." Linley said, "I fear the dead part, Sergeant." They went inside the house. They were immediately stopped by another patrol officer at the door to the sitting room. He had a spiral notebook in his hand. He barked, "You lot stay right there. This is a crime scene." Linley and Havers both produced their warrant cards. The words "New Scotland Yard" produced no ready miracles, but saved them from being thrown from the premises. The patrol officer said, "It's been phoned in if you think you're about to assist where you're not wanted." "We've no interest in interfering in whatever's going on," Linley told him. "But we must speak to Dina Donaldson on another matter, and it's essential we speak to her now. Is she here?"
"It's Fing! He got Fing!"
Ding had been in the sitting room, Linley saw, where the officer had been in the midst of taking a statement from her. She came towards them, wringing her hands. "Did you see who it was?" Linley asked her.
"Didn't I just bloody tell you lot?"
Ding cut into the officer's words by saying to him,
"I only want to talk to them."
"You'll talk to who you're told to talk to,"
the patrol officer snapped. "That sort of approach doesn't seem helpful," Linley noted.
"To put it kindly," Havers muttered. "Do you two want to be thrown—" "Oh, God, he's not dead, is he?"
Ding clapped a hand over her mouth. She was gazing past them. All of them turned. An ambulance's trolley was being carried down the stairs by two paramedics, its wheels folded, while from it a drip bag dangled above the form belted into position. A third paramedic shouldered a very large medical kit. The fact that there was a drip bag was reassuring, as was the fact that there was no body bag, but merely the blanketed boy himself. He wore a surgical collar, and his head was wrapped with bandages, while half a dozen butterfly plasters held the skin together on facial wounds. Linley said quietly to Havers, "Follow the ambulance. I expect it's going to the same location as the patrol car. Talk to the boy if you can. Not Finn, but the other. I doubt Finn'll be able to talk for a number of hours." When she nodded, took the keys and left him, he turned to Ding and said, "He's alive, Ding. Brutus has gone with the other officer in the patrol car, by the way."
"But he didn't do anything. I saw. There was a man."
"No, no," Linley said quickly. "I didn't mean he's been arrested. I expect he's being taken to hospital. There wouldn't have been room in the ambulance. They'll need the space to work on Finn."
"Don't make me tell his mum what happened," Ding said. "Please don't make me."
"You don't need to worry about that. There are procedures to be followed, and having you talk to anyone's parent isn't part of them." "If you're finished," the patrol officer said meaningfully. Linley, however, had no intention of doing anything save remaining where he was. He said to the officer, "As before, it's essential I speak to Dina. I'm afraid it can't wait. It's on another matter, but I think it likely that what happened here is connected." And to Ding, "Sergeant Havers and I have just come from speaking to Missa. She told us about the assault."
"There's someone who already bloody knows about this," the patrol officer demanded. "Just what the hell is going on?"
"This concerns a sexual assault that occurred in this house last December," Linley told him, and then to Ding. "It seems her grandmother got the story out of her and saw to it that she told her parents. I have to ask this, Ding. Did you see what happened here today?"
I wasn't home.
The girl first whimpered, and then as she continued, her voice started to waver.
Brutus, he was on the floor, and I could hear from Finn's room. There was a lot of noise. I went to the door and...
Her eyes filled.
I'd gone to talk to Francie, see? I didn't think that anyone... It's just that we never bothered with locking up, and anyway, we lost the keys ages ago. Mostly we just lock our rooms when we leave, but the house... That's why you lot got inside easy that one morning. Finn went mental about that, and his dad said he would handle everything, and I suppose we thought... Or at least I thought...
She stopped. It was as if she'd been struck. Then she suddenly began to pull at her cheeks, as if she'd scratch out her eyes, and she shrieked,
"It's my fault! It's my fault! Only I didn't know. I didn't understand. I ran off because I could, but she didn't. Only I didn't know. And it isn't my fault that I didn't know it. Only it is!"
"What the fuck is she on about now?" the patrol officer demanded. "I want you out of here, so I can get a straight story from her."
Linley turned to him, surprised by the amount of anger he felt of a sudden. For the first time he took in how young the other man was, how inexperienced, how ineffably and inexcusably ill-informed. He said, "Come with me, officer."
"I don't bloody take orders from—"
"I said come with me." His voice was louder than he intended. It was also steely. He was suddenly his father for the first time in his life, the last person he'd ever actually wanted to be. He took the patrol officer out of the house, speaking quietly now but with just as much iron intent. "We have a murder, a rape, and now both an assault and an attempted murder," he said directly into the young patrolman's face. "All of these crimes involve the same individuals in one way or another. Now, if you wish to stand in the way of an ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation because I'm on your patch, I suggest you think carefully before you take that decision. This isn't a turf war. Is that clear to you? These are human lives, and they're at risk, and believe me, I'm only too happy to take down your details and make certain your career is finished by next week. Am I being clear? Do you have any questions? If so, ask them now, because from this moment on, if you wish to remain in this house, you'll do so with your mouth shut." The officer opened his mouth, but closed it at once, as Linley said, "Yes? What exactly do you wish to say?" Apparently nothing, for the man went back into the house, where he retreated into the sitting room. He stood at something vaguely resembling attention at one side of the television, and from that moment on allowed Linley to speak to Ding. He had no chance to begin, because once he was in the room with the girl, she at once repeated,
"I can't tell his mum. Please don't make me tell his mum what happened."
"Both Finn's parents and Brutus's parents will be notified by the police or the personnel in casualty. You won't need to be involved." Linley indicated the worn and stained sofa, and when the girl sat, he joined her there as the only other choice was one of several huge bean bags, which he didn't fancy having to crawl out of when their conversation was at an end. He said to her, "Did you see the person who was beating Finn?" She nodded tearfully.
"I could see his back, and he had a poker."
She pointed to the wrought iron stand upon which the fireplace implements were hanging. The poker was not among them, so it had probably gone with the bloke when he left the house.
"He'd already hit Brutus, and he was standing over Finn."
Her eyes grew wide with realization, and she said,
"But Finn's meant to know karate. He's always going on about how his hands are weapons of death, and why didn't he use his karate?"
"Perhaps he's not quite as good as he's told you," Linley said. "Or perhaps he simply didn't have time. He could have been asleep still, and then suddenly someone was attacking him. Did you recognize the man? Or was it a boy, someone Finn might have met through his coursework?" She looked away in that fashion people had when they were attempting to remember exactly what they had seen of a crime. She said,
"A man, not a boy. Someone older than us."
"Could it have been Miss Lomax's father?"
"I never met anyone from her family, but a gran, because Missa lives—" "She lived with Mrs. Lomax when she was here at college, but I never saw her dad."
"Would you recognize the intruder if you saw a photo of him?" She didn't know, she said. All she knew was that he must have heard her when she ran to Brutus, or maybe he believed he'd finished Finn off. In either case, the next thing she knew was that he was tearing down the stairs and Finn was... He was just there, and his head was bloody, and Ding managed 999 on her mobile once she ran out of the house. She was too afraid to remain inside, she said, because there might have been others, and she knew she couldn't defend herself.
"Please don't tell," she added in a low voice. "I was meant to do something like first aid or whatever, but I was so scared I thought it was maybe a meth addict who was wanting to rob us, only there's nothing to steal."
"It's a good wager that this bloke wasn't an addict," Linley told her. If that's the case, he wasn't looking for drugs or for something to flog in order to purchase drugs. He was looking for exactly what he found. Brutus and Finn. "I'm going to ask this officer," here Linley indicated the patrolman, who was still in the position he'd taken up, although Linley saw he'd also written notes, "to fetch some photographs from Mrs. Lomax for you to look at. In the meantime, I'm going to ring your mum." She looked struck by horror.
"Why?"
he said. "This is a crime scene just now. There'll be officers coming to take evidence. Beyond that, I can't leave you here alone after what's happened." He took out his mobile and asked her for her mother's phone number. Ding tried to protest with,
"But my mum will make me—"
And he cut her off with, "I'll explain everything to her. She won't be angry. No one's about to be angry with you, Ding."
"I don't want to go home. Please don't make me go home."
"It will be for a short time only, just until the crime scene people gather what they can. I promise your mum will understand that." He tapped her mother's number into his mobile, and when he heard the ringing, he said to Ding, "I'll make certain she understands that this, here, today, has nothing to do with you." He waited until he heard a woman's voice before he covered the phone and added, "But that will be a lie, that last bit, won't it, Ding? So what I tell your mum when she arrives here to fetch you home is going to depend upon what you tell me now, at the end of this call." That wasn't fair, bargaining with a girl when she was so upset. But playing fair had gone by the wayside, and playing fair would remain there, as long as it took for him to get to the root of all that had occurred in Ludlow since the previous December. He assured Ding's mother, who turned out to be not Mrs. Donaldson but Mrs. Wellesby, that while her daughter was perfectly all right, something had occurred at her Ludlow residence that would require her to be fetched home for a day or two. Could Mrs. Wellesby manage that as soon as possible? No, Ding couldn't speak with her at the moment as she wasn't present, but she would be waiting for her mother's arrival. When he rang off to look at Ding, he said, "Now tell me about the end of autumn term, about the celebration, and about what happened after the celebration." Royal Shrewsbury Hospital, near Shelton, Shropshire. That they made it to Royal Shrewsbury Hospital in astounding time was owing to Clover's getting them there in a patrol car. She'd commandeered an officer who was happy to go at the road as if the devil were on his tail, sirens blaring and lights spinning. He'd barely braked at the entrance to casualty before they were out of the car and bounding towards the doors. "My son," Trevor said to the receptionist behind the check-in counter. When she didn't look up at once, he slapped the counter's surface and said, "Where's my son?" Then Clover was next to him, and from the corner of his eye he saw she had her police identification in her hand. She was wearing her uniform, so this seemed unnecessary, but it got them action enough when Clover said, "Deputy Chief Constable Freeman, our son's been assaulted in Ludlow." Reception jumped too. She picked up a phone and said into it, "George, is that copper still with? The one kid's parents are here." Then to Clover, "Name? I mean yours." Clover looked as if she wanted to reprimand the receptionist, since she'd already given her name and accompanied it with her police rank, but she merely said, "Clover Freeman, Trevor Freeman, our son is Finnegan." "Freeman," reception said into the phone. "Right, I'll tell them." And then to Clover, "An officer's coming out to have a word."
"Why can't we see him? What's happened to him?"
Trevor well understood her panic. Clover would know perfectly well that having an officer come out to have a word was how the worst possible news was passed along to the parents of a youthful victim. It was probably only 2 minutes that they had to wait, but time slowed as it does in the midst of a nightmare. Then the last person he expected to see came from within the depths of the hospital. It was the woman detective sergeant from the Met, Havers. She carried a notebook as if with the intention of interviewing them, which Trevor knew that Clover would not countenance. She joined them, saying,
"He's alive,"
for which Trevor was so grateful he thought his knees would give out.
"What happened?"
Clover asked.
"How bad is he?" "Not sure how bad his injuries are."
Her tone sounded as if she was making an attempt to be quite careful with what she told them.
"As to what happens, it looks like a break-in. Margov's with the girl who rang it in, and there's another officer there as well." "Gaz Raddick?"
Clover asked. Havers knitted her brow as if the question were not only unexpected, but also revealing. She said,
"Not Raddick. It's the patrol officer who got called from the centre. I've been talking to the other lad. This is the housemate. Know him, do you? And from what he said, he got attacked by some bloke swinging a fire poker or a tire iron, he's not sure which. He reckons someone got into the house by means of the front door not being locked."
"Christ, why won't they lock that bloody door?" Trevor cried.
"Kids, yeah, well, it wasn't a break-in in the usual sense. The boy, she glanced at her notebook, Bruce Castle, he's called, he came out of his room to use the loo, and this bloke started swinging the poker thing at him. He lifted his arm to protect himself like you do, and that was that. His arm was smashed.